Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
New York City, this is Film Spotting, streaming video units. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer, and on this episode of Film Spotting SVU, Allison and I will finally settle which of us is the true Hootie Tootie Disco Cutie when we discuss, God help us, the Greasy Strangler.
Later in this episode, we will bring you cue shots in which we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all with a common theme. And inspired by The Greasy Strangler, this is true, we considered devoting a podcast to disco-themed movies. We could have had some great music in there, but we were heartbroken to find that none of the admittedly fairly narrow sliver of films that could be considered disco cinema were streaming. When will we ever be able to discuss The Apple? And so instead, we went with a topic that The Apple would actually totally also have worked for, midnight movies, a category The Greasy Strangler definitely aims for. But before we get to that, let's do Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few titles that are new on demand. And Matt, this is your responsibility this time around. What have you got?
Well, first up, I've got clearly the most disco movie of 2016, Manchester by the Sea. Okay, it's not very disco. How about this, Allison? I will use, because we always have some music in between one of our segments, maybe I'll use some music from The Apple as one of the breaks. Would that be good? Okay, I'll let you pick the song. You can tell me later which song you want, and I will let you decide. So yeah, Manchester by the Sea. As we are recording this, it is a Oscar nominee, but by the time you're listening to this, there's a chance it could be an Oscar winner. Maybe we'll see. It is the latest film from writer-director Kenneth Lonergan. It stars Casey Affleck as a shy handyman living in Boston. He returns home to the Massachusetts town of the title when his brother, who's played by Kyle Chandler, dies suddenly, and his will names him, Casey Affleck, the legal guardian of his nephew, played by Lucas Hedges. And both Affleck and Hedges are Oscar nominated, along with Michelle Williams, who plays Casey Affleck's ex-wife. They're all terrific. I'm not sure any of them are going to win. I think Casey Affleck has a shot, but I actually don't think he's going to win. But we'll see. But they're all terrific. And the movie is both one of the saddest films of recent memory and also a surprisingly funny one, mostly thanks to that character who's played by Lucas Hedges, who has two different girlfriends that he's juggling without trying to let either of them know that they're one of two women he's seeing. And he has this terrible garage band that he plays in that we see at length. Very, very funny. That's really what I admired about the film, is the way it balanced these very conflicting tones in a way that to me felt completely organic, that did not feel out of place. It to me really kind of nailed the messy nature of life. One second things can be wonderful, and one second later things can be incredibly depressing. And that's the way it goes sometimes, and that's the way it goes in Manchester by the Sea. Which is a movie that I definitely recommend you check out, whether or not it wins any Oscars. It is available now on VOD. Next up, a movie that will be available on VOD on March 3rd, a film I haven't seen but I've heard good things about. I'm looking forward to seeing. It is called Catfight, and I will read you the plot description. Two bitter rivals pursue a grudge match that spans a lifetime. Struggling outsider artist Ashley, played by Anne Heche, and wealthy housewife Veronica, played by Sandra Oh, were close in college but have not seen each other since. When they find themselves attending the same glitzy party, verbal barbs lead to fisticuffs and an all-out brawl. So this is a literal metaphorical catfight, I guess, that will keep these two locked in combat for years to come. My colleague Aaron Whitney at our site Screen Crush gave it a positive review out of TIFF. That's where it premiered, I believe, and called it a total blast of these women beating the crap out of each other. So I'm looking forward to checking that one out. It is Catfight, available on VOD on March 3rd. And finally, available on March 7th, another Oscar nominee for its star Natalie Portman. It is Jackie. And Natalie Portman plays First Lady Jackie Kennedy in the days after the death of her husband in 1963. Billy Crudup plays this magazine journalist. He's writing an article about her life and the aftermath of this tragedy. And the film keeps jumping back and forth from their interview, where she is working very hard to sort of craft the image that's going to be presented in this piece, to her time in the White House, both before and after John F. Kennedy's death, where she is very instrumental in leading the charge to have this grand public funeral for him that will, in her mind, sort of ensure that he is remembered as this great figure. And what I liked about the movie was that sort of unique structure and the way it encourages you to think about the way media shapes our understanding of history and how sometimes those figures of that history can in turn use the media to shape our thoughts about that history. And you have Natalie Portman. She's very good in the film. I thought her accent was a little mannered and heavy at times, but
I thought that was deliberate.
Well,
I mean, I suppose whose accent she's doing had a very mannered accent.
I guess that's true
at times.
Pablo Larraín is a very good director from Chile. He's made some very good movies there. Very challenging films like Tony Manero and No. This is his first English language film. It's probably also his most accessible film to date, but it definitely has some of his personal touches, including very good period details, reconstructing these old sort of these old images using new technology, and that sort of deconstruction of the media and image making. It's all still in there. So that is Jackie, available on VOD on March 7th.
On Film Spotting SVU, we let you choose our main review by voting on one of three options. And this time around, we had you pick from the doc Author, the J.T. Leroy story, which you can find on Amazon Prime, the dark comedy The Greasy Strangler, which is also on Amazon Prime, and the Civil War slave drama The Retrieval, which, you've guessed it, is also on Amazon Prime. And despite a late surge from Author, The Greasy Strangler got the lead and held on to it in its greasy, greasy fingers. The Greasy Strangler is about... What is The Greasy Strangler about?
I'm glad this you get to do this and not me this time.
It's a tricky question. I suppose in one way, you could look at it at Jim Hosting's film as a heartfelt story about a parent and child attempting to find common ground after years of estrangement.
Very touching.
Yes. It is about a man named Big Ronnie, played by the fearless Michael St. Michaels, and his grown son, Big Braden, played by Sky Elobar, who live together with a dynamic that's like a, let's call it, an industrial male gray garden.
I was just going to say, yeah, I was hoping that was where you're going, and you did.
It's absolutely there.
Totally.
They support themselves by giving extremely implausible disco walking tours while wearing matching pink mock turtlenecks. These are tours in which they claim that seemingly random buildings are very important disco locations. Big Ronnie also sometimes strips his clothes off, covers himself in grease, and becomes a feral serial killer called the Greasy Strangler. In fact, he's really terrible at hiding. He just often blurts out, "I'm not the Greasy Strangler."
Well, he's not hiding. I mean, he's saying, "I'm not."
Right. Their imbalanced, codependent dynamic is thrown off when a woman named Janet, played by Elizabeth Durazzo, gets involved with one of the men and then the other. But story is really secondary to the strange and often grotesque imagery the Greasy Strangler attempts to imprint forever on your brain.
Very generous to say it's secondary.
It has an aesthetic I'd place somewhere between, let's say, slightly more whimsical David Lynch and Adult Swim on way harder than usual drugs. Sometimes it plays like a warped sitcom filled with Freudian father complex anxiety and also giant prosthetic dongs. It makes no concessions to the viewer in terms of providing explanations for its inexplicable world. You either get on its frequency or you will be left totally behind and outside of this movie. So, Matt, that's the key question. Did you get greasy?
Wait, the dongs were prosthetic? I'm kidding. I did sort of sit there watching going, please God, let these be prosthetic wangs.
There's multiple shots of it, particularly flapping in the breeze of a car wash dryer.
Yeah. Did I get on its wavelength? To a certain extent, I guess. I sort of begrudgingly admired what I would call the purity of impurity here. It is a disgusting movie. It is stupid. It is ridiculous. But within that disgustingness, there is a sort of ideological perfection, I would say, which, while I can't say I necessarily enjoyed all of this movie or I would ever watch it again, I didn't turn it off. I didn't bail. And I suppose I could have, although really to discuss it, I guess I would have had to have gritted it out even if I didn't like it. But I must admit there were times where I did laugh, and I actually really liked Michael St. Michaels as Big Ronnie. I thought his performance really was very naked and you said it fearless, I believe. I think that's a good way to put it. But it's also a fun performance. It really is. It carries the movie. And I enjoyed seeing him. I would like to see him in other things. I was just looking him up, you know, to see if I had seen him in anything else. He has done some other things, but it's, you know, I imagine this is something that he will be remembered for.
I was looking up an interview with him, and he talks about how he's basically kind of bounced around doing little things for a long time, including, as he put it, like being like a straight actor in porn films by a particular group back, you know, when I guess they needed non-porn actors to fill out scenes or
that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, which you know, seemed very kind of in character for all of the things he was totally game to do.
Yes.
He's already seen some things.
What about you? Did you like it?
Yeah, I suppose I appreciated it. How about that?
Yeah, appreciate is a good word. Yes.
I don't think I would say I'm in love with this movie, but I admire also the consistency of its totally weird world.
Yes.
You know, and not just the disco tour, not just the murdering, the ways, the vocabulary of it. There are particular terms that crop up again and again, and the characters almost get stuck on almost. One of them I will abbreviate into
BS artist
yes. For the sake of not having to bother labeling this podcast
or having me blurp them over and over. I appreciate that.
BS artist.
Yes.
Or being a smoothie with women.
Yep.
Or hootie tootie disco cutie. Yeah. There are these words that are used like chants,
nonsense
talismans.
Words.
Yes. That the characters get stuck on. There's something about that that is very hypnotic and that I appreciate. Or the long sequence in which a minor character mispronounces potato so time and time again and is asked to say it again and say it again and say it again. I don't know. There's like a perversity about it that I had to admire.
Yeah. There are some, I laughed. I mean, it wasn't just sitting there going, okay, this is very weird. And the thing that kept cracking me up was you mentioned the car wash and, you know, Big Ronnie, he greases himself up, I suppose, and then goes on these killing sprees. And then to transform himself back into a regular human, he goes to the car wash and goes through it, you know, just as himself,
naked man,
greasy, and they repeat the same exact shots each time. There's a shot of him sort of being whipped by the brushes and going ah, and then there's a jarring jump cut to him standing there totally naked, being like at the end being fanned, and he's just standing there, as you said, with his little Ronnie flapping in the breeze. It's not so little either. And they use those same two shots over and over again each time he kills someone. And it was funny the first time, but the fact that they kept going back to it every single time, it made me laugh. I laughed. Yeah. I laughed out loud, and not in a like this is so stupid kind of way. Like, I just thought it was genuinely funny.
It was funny. I mean, you said you don't think you'd ever watch this again, but honestly,
you could see yourself doing it.
I would definitely go back to watch those shots again because
that specific scene,
him
the car wash,
getting like hit by the kind of washer. Like, his face is incredible. There's just something about it that I love. Yeah, I don't know. There's this almost. It's like, I think the thing is also like there's something about its weirdness that is not aggressive towards the audience, you know, that I think sometimes when you watch, I've seen things with this particular sensibility that like draw out really long, prolonged jokes or things like that in a way that almost seemed like they're daring you to walk away.
Right.
And I did not feel that in this movie, that it, even in its repetitions, it is not deliberately trying to kind of provoke you to see how long you can stick around for this joke.
No, it doesn't seem like it's trying to, you know, it's not like, I mean, I guess it is provocative, but it's not trying to upset you, really.
Right, it's not trying throwing to have things fun. In your face.
Right,
yeah.
It's just trying to have fun. It's just, it's not that sort of aggressive tone to it. It's not, I'm trying to think what, you know, it's not the Human Centipede. It's not trying to make you puke and leave the theater. I could see someone getting up and leaving the theater, but just because it's so sort of strange and bizarre that you might say, what am I doing with my life watching this? But, you know, it has a quality of almost like, you know, wonderful, like, outsider art. Like, even the people in the movie, everyone is so kooky and strange, and they just don't look like the sort of people we normally see in a movie. And they just seem like these wonderful oddballs. And certainly their bodies, which we see a lot of, are not the sort of bodies we see in a lot of mainstream movies, which in a way I found refreshing, sometimes a little horrifying. There's, you know, watching one of these characters, let's say, pleasure himself, I found somewhat disturbing, somewhat amusing, and somewhat disturbing. But
I enjoyed Big Ronnie's disco outfit with like a strategic cutout.
Wow.
It's tremendous. Really something.
Just tremendous. Yes, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, the running, I found some of the running gags very amusing. These are almost literal running gags in some ways. But like I said, the purity of the impurity was the line I wrote down in my notes that I found, I came to a sort of begrudging respect and occasional good humor with this movie. I will say, in terms of things that I didn't really care for, I thought the movie, the ending of the movie, not the, there's an ending or a climax to this sort of love triangle, which I thought was fine, actually, and sort of unexpected, which I liked. But then it just kind of rambles on for another 10 minutes. And I honestly, I'm sure that there was something they were going for there, but I didn't think they quite achieved it. And I almost wish they had like ended the movie like eight minutes earlier.
Yeah, I felt like it. I agree. The ending is not one of the stronger points. I just felt like in the end, it didn't have, they didn't know where to end it.
They had no idea what, that's how it felt. Maybe this was all a very deliberate thing. And if we asked Jim Hosking what he was going for, he could lay it out in intricate detail. But just as a viewer, it felt to me like they said, okay, now what? We can't just end with the sort of the climax of the plot. We have to do something else. What do we do? And who knows? Maybe they had that location or something and they were there anyway and they just thought it would make... And it is a sort of unique visual that they achieve, but it just didn't quite land for me in the same way some of those other jokes do. It almost seems like it's trying to strain for some sort of like artfulness or like metaphorical beauty that I don't think the movie necessarily requires or that works at all with the rest of the content.
It made me think of Swiss Army Man, actually.
It
in
is
that way,
Swiss,
where
you know, I thought of the same thing, given that it, you know, these two people wandering through this landscape. That thought crossed my mind as well.
It seems to kind of try to like run out its original scenario. I just also like the kind of industrial. I don't know if it's supposed to be Los Angeles or
that's where I assumed it was.
Right.
I don't know.
It seems to be filmed in it's filmed in Los Angeles, wherever they're supposed to be. I just liked it so much. The kind of total empty weirdness of it.
And the sleaziness of it sort of fits perfectly with this greasy strangler character, too.
Right. Like, it's so empty, you know. There only seem to be, like, 10 people in all of...
I assume the greasy strangler had murdered everyone else.
Right. Well, you just also... You feel like he needs to space out his murders because he's just going to run out of people to murder very quickly.
It's true.
So, yeah.
It's very, very true. As we're wrapping it up here, the movie came out last year. Do you foresee a future of this movie since our topic is midnight movies, do you see a midnight movie or maybe more broadly like a cult audience forming around this movie?
Yes, I can see a cult audience forming around this movie. You know, it's this, I think, played at Sundance in the midnight section, which is not midnight movies that play in the midnight section and midnight movies are not synonymous necessarily.
No, midnight at Sundance just means like genre movies generally.
But also, I will say this, I think, which we can talk about in the next section, there's this larger question of, can you aim to make a midnight movie, or does midnight movie status have to be gifted upon you?
That's a good question.
Because certainly, I think Greasy Strangler aims for midnight movie status.
It does.
I think that it probably will achieve it in some way. I don't know if it'll ever have enough of a following to really, but I think it seems like the kind of movie you should watch at midnight.
Yes, if not later.
Yes, and that's when its logic makes the most sense.
Yeah, it should not be watched with a clear head in broad daylight, certainly. Yeah, I guess in a way the question is almost unfair because, like, is there such a thing as a midnight movie anymore? I mean, that's something we can talk about more broadly, is that it's sort of it's an outdated term, although there are theaters in New York that do it, still have midnight movies every single weekend. One other component of the movie that we have not addressed that I wanted to point out was the music. I loved the music in this movie. It's by a man named Andrew Hung. There's sort of a repetition of a theme that keeps popping up over and over, this sort of, I don't know how to describe it. It's almost like aggressive,
but it's also
angry,
playful.
But very playful, electronic music.
When I said it, there are times where it feels like a sitcom. There is something sitcom-y
about
it.
Yes, the way,
like,
it repeats over and over. It almost has like a Seinfeldian quality
exactly,
to it.
Exactly.
I love the music. That was one of my favorite parts of the way that music is like this transition between different sequences. And the theme that's the sort of the main musical theme that kind of recurs throughout the movie. When you first hear it, it kind of knocks you back in your chair because it is so sort of aggressive and strange, but it really fits the movie. And I thought that the score was just perfect for this weird vibe that they were going for. It just completely complemented it in every way.
Yeah, I would salute the music. I would salute the costuming, which is really
which I suppose would include certain parts of the anatomy as well.
The
lack of costumes in some scenes.
Yeah. But I think if you're going to watch this movie, the best reason is Michael St. Michaels, who really just goes for broke.
A performance for the ages.
It's really something else.
Yeah. So that is The Greasy Strangler, and it is available right now on Amazon Prime.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Magic apple, mystery apple, take a little ride, let me be your guide through the apple paradise. Juju apple, voodoo apple, take a little bite, spend a splendid night in our garden of delight. It's a natural, natural, natural desire. Meet an actual, actual, actual vampire. Let the apple set your soul on fire, fire, fire. You'll be hypnotized and you'll be demonized.
All right, as we segue here into midnight movies, I mean, we already sort of at the end of our Greasy Strangler review, we kind of got into it, the midnight movie. It does, to me, feel a little bit like something that is, it's a little, I don't want to say passé, but it's from another time, from an era when you couldn't just watch a weird thing on your computer. Because you didn't have a computer, because computers were gigantic things that were the size of a room.
Yeah. Or also when you wouldn't go to a midnight screening of on Thursday of whatever was opening the next day.
That's true.
Also, which
That's
I think
true.
Is like, that has kind of become what I think for a younger generation a midnight movie might mean.
Right. The new Spider-Man comes out. Now it premieres Thursday night. We go Thursday night, see it as soon as possible so we can start the conversation. You're right. That is almost a more popular midnight movie than the traditional, this is a weird thing that no one's seen that you should watch. Yeah, there, I mean, and I loved, maybe it's just because I'm old that I don't go anymore, but I used to love to go to midnight movies at the Landmark Sunshine, at the IFC Center. They were great, but and both of those theaters still do them. So it's not like they don't exist anymore, and I think a lot of theaters still do, but it seems like a concept whose moment has passed.
It does. Yeah. I wonder. I feel like I'm bad at midnight movies because I always drift asleep during them. Though that's kind of
that's sort of the
experience.
Yes.
Yes. Which is why oftentimes midnight movies are not the best paced movies in the world, because it's fine if you fall asleep for a chunk. But I will say this. I think the idea of midnight movies as kind of existing in defiance of like regular movie going rules still like sticks around. You know, what's bad is good. Audience participation and reaction is like a plus.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it's also a place where you go to see that you associate with movies that are transgressive in some way. So I still appreciate the idea of this slot as one in which, you know, all of the usual things that you would have in place when you go to see a movie, you're kind of like overturned.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful idea. The idea that, because it's almost like you said, breaking the rules, I think, is a big part. But while midnight movies can have a broad sort of definition, there's many different kinds of midnight movies.
Yeah, like there's a lot of overlap with like what you would call cult films,
right.
But there's a lot of other things in there as well.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be any particular, like there's many different kinds of genres. But I think one thing that a lot of them do have in common is that they are all, in some ways, rule breakers, whether they have an enormous amount of gore or blood or violence, or they're so strange or they're, you know, bizarre that they break the rules of logic or plot, or they're very poorly made. They break the rules of filmmaking. That's another very popular category of midnight movie. So, yeah, you also said the word transgressive, which I think is another very appropriate word here, that's what you're looking for in a real prototypical midnight movie. For I don't know how you did your picks, but I sort of did mine like as the two things that I feel like deserve to be midnight movies. I've never seen them shown anywhere at midnight. That doesn't mean they haven't been. But like these are the things, like if you gave me control of a movie theater, and for the life of me, I can't understand why no one has, these are some of the things that I would want to program at midnight that I feel like would play well there, that maybe haven't gotten their moment in the sun or in the darkness, since these are midnight movies.
I picked two films that I feel embody two different approaches to the idea of midnight movie. And I think that both of them have probably played at midnight at places. I know one of them has. Mm-hmm. The other one just seems like it should only ever be watched at midnight or after. I watched it in the bright light of day and
it didn't work.
It wasn't that it didn't work. I just felt like I should hide. I'll talk about that one first. How
okay.
about that?
Well, very briefly, before we get into the movies, I just wanted to ask, have you ever read the book Midnight Movies by Jay Hoberman and Jonathan Rosenbaum?
I have not.
Fabulous book. It is one of my all-time favorite movie books. It is about the general phenomenon of midnight movies, and they talk about the history of them. So if you're curious, how did midnight movies start? You can read all about that there. And then they talk about specific movies like Pink Flamingos and Eraserhead, and I think El Topo is in there as well. It's a great book. I'm looking right now. It looks like it might be out of print. If you can get, and it doesn't look like it's cheap to get it out of print either, but if you can get a copy, it's a great, great book. One of my all-time favorite books, so that's recommended. All right, let's get to our picks. You want to go first?
Sure. So for my first pick, I wanted to pick something that I felt is a midnight movie because, as I've said, it feels too inappropriate to play in the bright light of day.
Okay.
And as we mentioned, I think like transgressive movies is definitely movies that are too shocking to, you know, play in normal slots, is kind of an idea that I think certainly accompanies part of at least the aspect of what it means to be a midnight movie. So for my first pick, I'm going to talk about Necromantic. N-E-K, R, romantic, which is streaming on Shudder. And this is a 1987 German film from Jörg Butgereit, I believe is a
good old Jörg. Good old Jörg.
A movie that is famously banned in multiple countries. And in fact, I don't think ever got officially rated in Germany. Instead was made with the understanding it would never, you know, be allowed to kind of play in a mainstream place. Courtesy of its rather graphic depictions of necrophilia. Yes, it is an exploitation film. And it is, in the ways of exploitation films, it is even more effective for how roughly it's made, how kind of clearly low budget it is. The low budget gore effects and corpses are clearly like kind of handmade and are much more disturbing for it and kind of much more effective in that way that sometimes happens. But what really makes it linger in the mind, also I should point out, even if you don't find fairly graphic necrophilia disturbing, you will probably be disturbed by another running theme in this movie, which is that it contains footage of real animal slaughter.
Oh,
yes,
no.
I know. And I always find it.
Don't like that.
I always find it interesting when people are like, you know, cannibalism, necrophilia, like whatever, most gory violence
but
at all.
But don't you touch
like,
that dog.
Animals, no.
Yeah, that's a line I don't like crossing.
But what really makes this linger in the mind is the ways in which all of this shocking imagery is paired with this extremely mundane story about how the main character loses his job and then is left by his girlfriend. Like, it is it's necromantic. It is a story of romantic tragedy in which the main character, Rob, starts when working at a company that cleans up corpses after accidents and from crime scenes. It's a perfect job for someone with his predilections. And we see that he has found a soulmate in Betty, his girlfriend, who shares his sexual tastes. So he shows up at home with a rotting corpse, and then they proceed to frolic, and then they have, you know, breakfast. And I think that, like, that divide is part of the reason that this movie seems, I think, so much more interesting than one that just tries, as many movies have, to just be shocking. You know, there's a whole list of movies out there that just, like, serve up disturbing imagery. The one I always think about is a Serbian film, which played at Fantastic Fest, like, a few years ago, and was literally just a series.
I've still never seen it.
It's just a series of extremely, like the most aggressively, like, are you shocked yet? Are you grossed out?
Right.
Are you horrified? Like, images. In Necromantic, there are a lot of the kind of like disturbing images are tied into heartbreak, basically, as this guy gets struggles to find connection after his girlfriend leaves him and takes their last corpse with her. And he just kind of drifts around. The movie
happens.
Also, I think, kind of manages some commentary on the idea of being kind of like jaded to violence and spectacle. The main character shows up at a movie that is a violent slasher film, sexualized violence all over the place, and everyone in the audience is shown to be kind of like bored and not paying attention. But I don't think that I think you can give a lot of reads to it because it is so sparse that it almost invites, you know, more complicated readings than I think are necessarily there. What does, I think, stick around for this movie and what does make it such a good midnight movie is it's the most shocking movie to also just be about rattling around your apartment having recently been broken up with, which is really, you know, I think kind of admirable. So that's Necromantic. You can find it on Shudder.
All right. That's an interesting movie. I got to admit, when you told me about it, I looked it up and the cover looks familiar. So I guess I've seen it in the video store way back when.
At Kim's,
for sure.
But
I've never seen it. I'm not too familiar with it. It sounds like a true midnight movie.
It's only also like 75 minutes long.
That is a plus for a midnight movie. Nobody wants to be at the theater too late.
Right.
All right. For my first pick, I went with a movie that I, again, sort of think deserves that cult audience deserves to be a midnight movie, but has never really found that. It is available on Amazon Prime. You can also watch it on YouTube, where its distributor, Troma, has put it up for free. And many, many years ago, when I was an intern at Troma, the company that, if you've never heard of them, made films like The Toxic Avenger, The Toxic Avenger 2, The Toxic Avenger 3, Citizen Toxie, The Toxic Avenger 4, and other great classics of art cinema. While I was there, I actually sort of, I would say I didn't really play a role, but maybe a tiny role, but at least witnessed the release of this movie. And it's called The Stabilizer. It is an Indonesian action film that is truly deranged. And the story behind the release of it from when I was there was this would have been the summer of 2000, and the person who was in charge of Troma's DVD department was looking through the company's archive, which, and I'm sure if you know Troma, you'll be shocked to discover this, was not well cataloged, and it wasn't even entirely clear like what movies they owned and what movies they could release. And they found this, or he found this Betamax tape that had different trailers, and he was looking at like what movies do we have that we could release. And there was a trailer for this movie called The Stabilizer, and no one in the audience had heard of this movie. And you can find the trailer on YouTube now. And he showed it to me and a bunch of people, and everyone who watched it agreed this is the greatest action movie. Just from the trailer, this is the most ridiculous action movie that we've ever seen, and it needs to be released. And he put it out on DVD, and it is incredible. And thinking about it now, in a way, it almost reminds me of The Raid, or especially The Raid 2. When you're, well, let me explain. Don't get ahead of me. Hold on. Wait. You know, it's just the idea of watching it and going, wow, the people who made this, they were taking some risks. When you watch people like in an action movie where you're like, wow, this looks dangerous, right? So it's sort of like The Raid, but then mixed with like Plan 9 from Outer Space. So instead of looking wild and dangerous, but also feeling kind of very slick and very competent like The Raid does, it's like this looks wild and dangerous. And it was made by people who had no idea what they were doing. That's the vibe. So it almost doesn't look like you're watching stunts. It almost looks like you're watching people just doing things. I'm not 100% certain that no one was harmed or maybe killed watching this movie. People may have died. I don't know. I don't want to know because I just love watching it. The story involves a American super cop who arrives in Indonesia looking to catch a criminal named Greg Rainmaker, who is scum. And I know he is scum because the cop says, "I despise scum like Greg Rainmaker," a few times. And the cop is known as the Stabilizer, Peter O'Brien, because he stabilizes situations, because so you call him the Stabilizer. Arguably, he doesn't stabilize things. I'm not sure how jumping off of helicopters and getting into crazy car crashes makes him stabilize things, but it's fine. He hates Greg Rainmaker because he killed his girlfriend. Would you care to guess how he killed his girlfriend, Allison?
I have no idea.
He killed her by kicking her with cleats.
What?
Like golf shoes, but really, but very pointy.
I understood. I mean, just like...
This is his secret weapon. Throughout the movie, he walks around in very pointy cleats and kicks people. This does
sound very dangerous.
Yes. So it's very demented. It's very bizarre. It's very entertaining. And just some of the stunts are absolutely bonkers. You know, and the wonderful thing about it, you know, you mentioned not all Midnight movies are paced well. I give the Stabilizer credit for a marvel of pacing. It starts fast and it never lets up. And they find ways to continually top themselves. So you go, okay, well, they're not going to top driving the truck into that river. That's not going to happen. And then, wow, they're definitely not going to top that scene where a guy gets headbutted by a motorcycle. That's not going to be topped. That can't. And then they jump out of a helicopter and he shoots at the helicopter while he's falling and blows the helicopter up. I mean, it's magnificent. It really is. If any of this sounds interesting to you, I strongly urge you to check it out. It is wonderful. It is very ridiculous. It is very, very crazy and very, very fun. It is The Stabilizer, available on Amazon Prime or on YouTube.
All right. I would totally watch that. That's
it's good. Great. It's so good. I also despise scum like Greg Rainmaker, but go ahead, Allison.
Yes. Well, so for my second pick, I wanted to kind of have something that maybe encompasses two separate things that I think you could look for in a independent movie. The like so bad it's good quality that is sometimes there, but also this wasn't bad at all. This just wasn't appreciated by mainstream audiences quality.
Yes.
You know, where something like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the definitive midnight movie, did not do that well when it was in mainstream release, but
that's
then went on to
kindly.
Have a long, long life
yes.
as a midnight movie. So for your consideration, your midnight movie consideration, I did want to submit Tank Girl, which is available for rent. The Rachel Talalay directed 1995 film adapted from the Alan Martin and Jamie Hewlett comic. It was a troubled production. It was not a success when it came out with critics or at the box office, which is unfortunate because it was a production that had a lot of interesting talent, including Catherine Hardwicke as the production designer and Stan Winston, who did prosthetics and makeup. So a lot of talent attached.
Based on a comic book, which nowadays, come on.
I know. Well, I think that's one of the things that is interesting about it, is that in this way that like is so I think significant in terms of like being before the era in which a comic book was like source material to make a giant blockbuster, it makes such a big deal out of being adapted from a comic book. Like, it folds in whole comic book panels, it folds in animated sequences in which the characters, as they were drawn in the comic book, kind of fill in sequences, which I'd read somewhere and could not find a like kind of definitive confirmation of this, was because whole important sequences were not shot, and so they had to have animated filler to like to make it so they had something to put there. This movie actually has gone on to have a bit of a midnight movie life, I think, because its universe is so vivid. It's set in a dystopian Australia in which, Fury Road style, water is a precious commodity mostly controlled by an oppressive dictator, in this case a corporate one, played by Malcolm McDowell, who's the head of the Water and Power Corporation. The title character, a.k.a. Rebecca, is played by Lori Petty, while her eventual partner in rebellion, Jet Girl, is played by, Matt, do you know?
I don't know.
Naomi Watts.
Wow.
Yes. She was the sidekick in this movie.
Wow.
Yes. And then there are all kinds of like very memorable bits of imagery. There's these devices that can be like jabbed into people that will kill them by sucking out their blood and transforming it into water. There are human kangaroo hybrid soldiers, one of whom is played by Ice-T, and another one of becomes Tank Girl's love interest. Iggy Pop makes an appearance. There's a scene in a futuristic sex club in which everyone is made to sing Cole Porter's Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love. It is a messy movie, but it is also a very distinctive one in a way that feels very endearing. I think in a way that feels like one a crowd would get behind, you know, especially since I think this movie has faded from memory enough that it can become the kind of discovery that I think can fuel midnight movie success. And in particular, I would say the make or break quality of this movie is Lori Petty's performance as Tank Girl. It is one that you will either love or hate. She is basically like a punk rock Bugs Bunny bouncing through the apocalypse, only ever able to make wisecracks no matter how bad things get. There's a whole sequence in which Malcolm McDowell tortures her more and more, and she just cannot stop quipping back at him no matter how she looks like rougher and rougher each time she gets brought up. It is, I think, not by no means a great movie, but it is one that has that spark of life to it that seems like it would make people happy to discover it. And I think that that is a quality of midnight moviness, the ability to have a discovery of a movie that's no longer in mainstream kind of discussion, that is important and worth calling out. So that's my second pick, Tank Girl, available for rent.
Okay. My next pick, well, I went a little bit outside of the box because, as we discussed earlier, I felt like, you know, the midnight movie, it isn't what it once was, and I think that a lot of the energy that used to go into making the movies that wound up as midnight movies has gone elsewhere. It's gone to the internet, it's gone to television, and sometimes it's gone to both. And so for my second pick, I did not pick a movie, and I picked the thing that to me felt the most like a true midnight movie of recent memory. It premiered on television way after midnight, debuted actually at 4 a.m, which could be one of the latest world premieres ever, I think. And it became a viral video sensation. It's been seen over 12 million times. So in a way, it's almost not quite cult, but I think that's sort of the way that this is this new world that we're living in. And to me, other than The Room, it seems like the most pure like midnight movie of the last decade or so, even though I don't think it's ever played in a theater at all at any time, midnight or otherwise. But it just, I don't know. It seems like the thing that to talk about here. And it's, have you any idea what I'm talking about?
I have a very good idea of what you're talking about.
It is Too Many Cooks, directed by Casper Kelly, still available on YouTube. It's not a feature-length film, but it's 12 minutes long. But I just couldn't imagine. I can't imagine anything being like a better midnight movie that's been released like in the last decade or so than Too Many Cooks, except maybe The Room, which is probably the only true like midnight movie that's emerged.
Birdemic also, you might.
Yeah, Birdemic. Yes. And I've seen Birdemic at midnight at an actual movie theater.
Too, yeah.
We were at the same screening, I think, where it premiered. And it's one. And that is wonderful, too. But I don't think Birdemic has the same reach that The Room does. The Room, I think, has a legitimate cult midnight movie following. I think Birdemic plays at that time and has a, I think, has a devoted smaller following, but just doesn't seem quite as, it doesn't seem to have quite the same reach as The Room. Anyway, Too Many Cooks was created, written, and directed by Casper Kelly, made for Adult Swim, the adult programming block on Cartoon Network. It begins as a sort of parody of schlocky 90s sitcom opening sequences that were very ubiquitous when we were kids, Allison and I, where you have this ridiculously cheerful theme song and the cast would be introduced one by one. They'd each be doing something, washing the dishes, playing with a toy, walking into a room. And they would always do the same thing where they would just kind of like turn to the camera and then like, oh, hi, give like a knowing like, smile. Didn't see you there.
Yeah.
It's so great to see you. And that was the way that these looked. And at first, Too Many Cooks looks like it could be any one of these sequences, but then it keeps going and going long past when any of these real opening sequences would have, and it starts getting stranger and stranger, and it changes genres, it changes mediums, it becomes an animated opening credits at one point. And then the sheer logic of the film begins to break down, and it turns into something totally different. And all of the different elements, they just blend together one to the next so perfectly, so seamlessly. It's just so amazing. When it first happened, I loved it. And I just rewatched it for the first time since then. And I was like, this is perfect. This little thing, for what it is absolutely perfect. It's so funny. The details of the period stuff are on point. And then it becomes so bizarre and creepy and wonderful. And I have to say, it is one of my great regrets of life that I wasn't randomly watching television at 4 in the morning, flipping channels. I just think if you had found this thing, perhaps in an altered state of mind, at 4 in the morning on Adult Swim, I can only imagine what you would have thought. You must have thought, like, it's real. It must have been amazing. I wish I could have seen it that way. And I really think that it would play great in a movie theater. You know, like if I had my movie theater to show movies in, if I was showing something else at midnight, I would show this first unannounced and just see what happened. Why not? It's got a lot of that stuff we were talking about before about midnight movies. It breaks the rules, crosses over into different kinds of genres. It's very strange. Would play well under the influence of one or multiple substances. And it does have a fuzzy puppet cat named Smarf. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend it. I would recommend wait until late at night. You don't have to do 4 a.m., but wait until it's late. Hey, maybe invite friends over and then put it on and not tell them you're going to put it on and just see what happens. I'm sure they'll all appreciate it and thank you later.
Yeah, but you should be prepared to have that theme song stuck in your head for the rest of your life.
Yes, and if you do, lucky you. So that's Too Many Cooks. It's available on YouTube. We are going to briefly talk about the big new movie coming to theaters the weekend you will be receiving this podcast, next Friday, March the 3rd. It is Logan. Logan, the third and supposedly final solo Wolverine film starring Hugh Jackman as Logan, the Wolverine, whatever he's... Here he's just going by Logan.
This is his last, supposedly.
Supposedly, this is the final time he will play this role. Yes. I honestly believe we will see him play, even for a cameo somewhere. I firmly believe that we will not. This is not the last one.
Yeah, it has been 17 years of him in this role,
which is mind-boggling when you think about
it. Also, especially since he is like more jacked now.
He's a more jacked man than he was then.
Than he was.
It's true. If you go back and especially the first one, if you go and look at the first one, he is so young, so baby-faced, and over the years. you know, he's, I feel like he's kind of, in a way, his grittiness as he's gotten older has worked well with the role.
It has, yeah.
And his refusal to eat bread and eat nothing but chicken and like vegetables and brown, maybe
0.5% body fat. Yeah, maximum. Just,
he's gotten so incredibly ripped up. That it's true. He is, of all the superheroes, he seems the one who's most dedicated to, like, not only, like, you know, like creating that superhero body, but maintaining it across all the movies. A lot of times they'll, like, you'll notice, like, that first movie they show up in great shape, and then the second movie you're like, boy, he's wearing a lot of t-shirts in this one.
Right.
And you go, okay, I get it. You know, he didn't want to get in the ripped shape. He's proven it before, doesn't need to prove it again. Not huge jacked man. He likes to get ripped to shreds. He is huge. So besides his physical state, which obviously is very impressive, what did you think of the movie?
Oh, I loved it. I thought it
you
was
loved
great.
It.
Yes. I would say, despite it's not perfect by any means, but I think I think every time I think that I am so exhausted by the superhero genre, every once in a while something like this will come around where you're like, it's not just that it is a very good kind of elegy to this character.
Mm-hmm.
It also, I think, reflects in interesting ways back on the whole franchise. In particular, and I wrote about this a bit, it's an R-rated movie. The way it uses violence makes you rethink how violence, you know, kind of has been portrayed in all of the other movies in a much more bloodless, cartoonish way.
That is true.
And in this movie, it's almost like you're like waking up from a dream into a reality in which, you know, Wolverine smashes his claws through someone's skull, and it's totally graphic and like, you know, violence seems like a burden on these characters in this movie, which is not to say that the fight scenes are not mostly pretty exciting.
Yeah, this is unusual in that I almost feel like you enjoyed a comic book movie more than I did, but I liked it a lot. I don't know that I liked it as much as you did, though. But it is a very fitting send-off for the character for all the reasons that you said, and the fact that it is very R-rated, very violent, very bloody, while sometimes that sort of stuff in these kinds of movies I find kind of off-putting, the, you know, urge to be very adult and gritty, and it's all appropriate in this case. It suits the material, it suits the character, it suits the story, and you're right, it does cast an interesting light on those earlier X-Men and Wolverine movies where he's stabbing guys, slashing these claws left and right, and no one ever bleeds or gets cut up
except
or anything.
Except for him, really.
Except for him, because he can heal.
He can heal. I mean, what better kind of like embodiment of like PG-13 violence is there than Wolverine, someone who can never permanently get hurt?
That's
you know,
true.
Who is kind of this indestructible person who has an incredibly savage kind of weapon built in and yet never, you know, leaves body parts flying around until this movie.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, the whole fact that he can heal is a big part of this movie, because in this one he's older, and for reasons we won't spoil, for some reason he's sick and he's maybe dying, and his healing factor is just not working the way it used to, which is not great for the character in his well-being, but it's great for the movie because I found it much more suspenseful watching him. Whereas in previous movies, it was always fun to watch him because Hugh Jackman was great. He really was intense. He really embodied this Wolverine character. But you never really got too worried about his well-being because he's always going to be fine because he's Wolverine. And he can't be killed. And here he is so much more vulnerable. And it makes the movie a lot more suspenseful.
Yeah, it's a whole movie about consequences that we're just like are not usually there in kind of other movies in this genre. Like, it is about consequences and it's about death. Like,
yeah,
it is a very death fixated movie.
It's a pretty intense movie. It's pretty dark. It's pretty serious. I feel like it is, in a lot of ways, it embodies a lot of those, like, the cliches of movies that I don't like this.
The grimdark.
Yeah. But
this
it's
does
maybe
not feel grimdark, though.
No, it feels like, in a way, it feels, I mean, it, one of the things I think I wrote in my notes, I don't know if I wrote this in my review, it's just like, you know, a lot of these kinds of movies now, especially these days, are using adult content, but they don't really feel adult. They feel they're very immature, and
right.
they're just throwing around more violence, more sex, and more swear words. Right, because you know there's an audience for it. As
well, I think,
movies
you know,
have proven,
we neither of us was a big fan of Deadpool, which
right.
is the other recent R-rated movie, which actually is, I think, that is the definition of Deadpool. It
yes.
is a movie that kind of is extremely it's not just juvenile in its humor, and like, I don't mean that as a dismissal of its humor. I think it is juvenile in terms of just
by design.
It doesn't, it also in terms of just like not managing to actually deviate from all of the things it's making fun of.
Right. Right. And it's, I think it's possible that we would never have gotten this movie without Deadpool. So if that's the case, huzzah to Deadpool. Another reason to like Deadpool, I suppose. But yeah, this movie, you know, it's not just, it doesn't have just have adult content. It feels like a movie, an adult movie, a serious movie. Now, it does have a guy with claws coming out of his hand stabbing people, but it really feels like a serious consideration of this guy and of this world and what it means to have these characters walking amongst the movie, the people of movies, if not us.
Right.
And you know, and I will say that it does have some lightness too with Patrick Stewart. I thought Patrick Stewart was great. He's sort of like Professor X has sort of dementia, and that's made him dangerous and made him
old,
a little
and
old and cranky,
yeah.
and kind of charmingly funny at times. I thought he gave a great performance, one of his best in the entire series, actually. And he seems to be having a great time too, because you know Professor Xavier is always such a serious person, very straight-laced, and the characters Patrick Stewart tends to play in general are very serious, and he is, you know, he is the sort of one kind of note of goofiness at times in the movie, and he seems to be having a great time. And yeah, it's fun.
It is fun. The one other thing I will say, and something that I really appreciated about this, is that just like so much of the conflict in this movie is not conflict that can be fought in a giant battle against a pillar of light. You know,
that's true.
There's that, so much of it is just that the world is getting worse in ways that like none of the characters can battle.
Mm.
They can just run away from.
Right.
And I thought that there were, it's a genuinely dark but realistic concept,
totally.
You know, that I think that you don't often kind of, is not something that the superhero movies that tend to try and tackle. And I thought that Logan did it really well.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the things that I didn't like quite as much as you, I felt it was a little long. I didn't love that. There's a last section.
Yeah.
That
it's certainly
doesn't
the weakest.
Work to me.
It's certainly the weakest.
There's
part.
Like a Deus Ex Machina that I won't describe that to me felt super convenient, super, it didn't fit with the rest of the movie, and it, in a way, it reminded me a little of the last Wolverine movie, which James Mangold also made, which was like very serious for a long time and then had like a big robot fight at the end. This one isn't that broad. It stays more grounded, but it just in the way that it kind of escalates to this kind of dumb, big fight that I didn't think was that great, it just seemed like it felt studio note-y to me in a way that the rest of the movie felt like something a studio note would never produce. It felt like an artistic statement that they felt a little hedged to me at the end. Having said that, the final shot of the movie is fantastic. So it's good. It is worth seeing. It is it's a very, very good one of these movies. And it's a nice farewell for the huge Jackman. Now he can go eat bread. I hope he enjoys many slices of pizza. He's earned it. You've earned it, Hugh Jackman. You've earned it. All right, let's get to Behind the Eight Ball. Let's count down some new releases on streaming. Let's give you some listener recommendations that you guys sent to us at our email address, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And also, one film chosen by my list. Allison?
Yes.
Do you want to go first? You want me to go first?
I want to go first.
All right. So let's start off with three new releases on streaming.
Okay. First up is I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, a title I have so much trouble keeping in my head. But what a world we live in which the winner of the dramatic competition prize at Sundance last month is now available to stream, courtesy of Netflix. This was a Netflix original, a 2017 comedy, thriller, crime drama, written and directed by Macon Blair, his directorial debut. You may remember him from Blue Ruin, Jeremy Saulnier's film, and also from Green Room. And this movie definitely has a Jeremy Saulnier-esque feel to it. It is both very brutal and very funny as well, and stars Melanie Lynskey and Elijah Wood, both of whom are really fun in this. So that is on Netflix. New to Amazon Prime and Hulu, 10 Cloverfield Lane, Dan Trachtenberg's spiritual sequel to Cloverfield, starring John Goodman, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and John Gallagher Jr. An interesting movie. I didn't like the ending, but I liked most of the rest of it. I thought it was well directed. And finally, new to Amazon Prime is Shotgun Stories. This is the 2007 debut film from Jeff Nichols, who has more recently done Midnight Special and Loving, and starring his muse, Michael Shannon. In a story of feuding families. It's quite a directorial debut. So that is on Amazon Prime.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Well, first up, we have so many listener recommendations courtesy of the competition, the drawing that we were doing, this giveaway. So thank you everyone who wrote in. Now going to work our way through them over the next few episodes. So first up, I have one from Natalie in France who writes, first of all, congrats on your show, which helps me sort out all the new releases in the streaming world. You guys have amazing taste. I'd like to recommend two movies streaming on Netflix, Miss Stevens, which stars the great Lily Robb and could be a fine companion piece to The Edge of 17. And We Are the Best, which you may have recommended a couple of years ago. We did. I think we actually, like, that was a main review we did. So you can look for that back in our archives. It is a wonderful film about a Swedish punk rock girl band, a great companion piece to Sing Street. I would also recommend a science fiction series streaming on Amazon Prime, Humans. The second season is starting now on AMC. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Natalie, for that. And I have a recommendation from Ashley in Denver, who recommends Eastbound and Down,
nice.
Now available on Amazon Prime.
Nice.
Ashley writes, I recently rewatched all four seasons, and one would think a deep dive into the psyche of a willfully ignorant bully would be incredibly wearing in this day and age. But Danny McBride's Kenny Powers is extremely lovable, as is the rest of the cast. I really enjoyed rewatching Danny McBride and John Hawkes fighting over badly needed toilet paper in season one, and Matthew McConaughey's erotic prayer to Jesus in season three. So that's on Amazon Prime. Thank you for that, Ashley.
All right. And how about one film chosen blindly by number from your My List?
You give me number eight. Number eight on my List is Magicians, Life in the Impossible.
Oh my God.
It's a documentary about magicians.
Is it?
Because I like magic.
Really?
I do. And
magic.
Also, I just honestly, I cannot wait for the Oscars to be over, for me to have finished writing about them and to just settle in
and watch about some magic.
It's not at all awardsy documentary about magicians.
It's an illusion.
Yes. All right, Matt, are you ready?
I mean, I don't have anything as cool as a documentary about magicians, but I'll do my best.
No, who does?
Yeah.
All right, three new releases.
All right, first up on Netflix is Clouds of Sils Maria, written and directed by Olivier Assayas and starring Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart. Binoche plays a famous film actress. Stewart is her assistant. It's about the relationship between the two women and also about Binoche's character's career and what it means to be a woman who is getting a little older in this industry obsessed with youth. It's an awesome movie, great performances, fabulous ending, very much worth checking out. Clouds of Sils Maria on Netflix. Next up on Hulu is American Teen, a 2008 documentary from Nanette Bernstein, who was the co-director of The Kid Stays in the Picture, which was that great Robert Evans documentary from now, like, I don't know, 20 years ago? Oh, God. The film was marketed as this kind of like documentary that was almost like a real life John Hughes movie, like a bunch of teenagers who all go to the same high school in this little town in Indiana. And there are several characters who fall into these sort of teen stereotypes like The Breakfast Club. So there was a jock and there was a geek and so on and so on. And it followed a year in their lives. And I remember finding it interesting at the time as this kind of modern look at teen life and also a reconsideration of those John Hughes types. And now it's almost 10 years later. I thought this might be an interesting movie to rewatch now and see how modern does it feel in 2017, or does it now seem just as dated as an 80s teen movie? I don't know. I thought that would be interesting to look at it for that reason. That's American Teen on Hulu. Finally, on Amazon Prime, we have Captain Fantastic, an Oscar nominee for its lead actor Viggo Mortensen. He plays the father of this family. They live in isolation out in the wilderness. And then he and his children take a road trip to attend a funeral. It sounded to me kind of like a very like cliched sort of Sundance movie, but I've heard nothing but good things about this, including some people who thought that Viggo Mortensen gave the best performance of the year. And he is, as we're recording this anyway, Oscar nominated. I don't think he's going to win, but it's always nice to be nominated. And I have to admit, I missed this movie in theaters last year, and I'm looking forward to catching up with it on Amazon Prime, Captain Fantastic.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
All right, first I have a recommendation from Keith. And Keith says, I figured I would take this time to try and accomplish a few things in one go. And oh, let me start over, because I'm just going to leave this, just yeah, go to, straight to his recommendation. Yeah. All right, our first recommendation from... All right, my first recommendation comes from Keith. Keith writes, I would like to recommend my most underrated Why Isn't Anyone Talking About This Film pick of 2016, Kicks. I have read it argued that Kix is perhaps a bit over-directed, but for a young filmmaker, that is perhaps the best kind of backhanded compliment slash critique. I really loved what director Justin Tipping attempted to do with this film. A central metaphor involving an astronaut who is referenced throughout the film is a perfect example of the quote-unquote over-directed complaint, but for me, it never tipped over into mawkishness, and I really respected the director's ambition. Another reason to recommend this film is the cast, which includes Mahershala Ali and newcomer Joaquin Guillory in a standout performance. I found the specificity of place and the stylistic flourishes of the film really helped distinguish it from others that seek to explore similar territory, and it has me extremely excited to see what Justin Tipping makes next. It's a real shame this one seems so overlooked in 2016. So that is Kix, which is currently available for rent. Thank you for that recommendation and a much longer email, which we don't have time to share, from Keith. Next up, I've got an email from Todd in Phoenix, Arizona. Todd writes, here is my listener recommendation. Check out any or all offerings of Riff Tracks on Amazon Prime. If you're a fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, then you will be a fan of these equally hilarious movies that are riffed by many of the same crew. Amazon Prime offers one or two dozen of these. All great stuff. So that is Riff Tracks on Amazon Prime, and that was a recommendation from Todd in Phoenix. Thank you, Todd. And yes, the Riff Tracks, it's a whole enterprise they have, but they did recently add a whole bunch of them to Amazon Prime. I haven't had time to watch them. I've seen a few Riff Tracks before, but I haven't seen any of the ones on Amazon, so I've got to check those out. Thank you, Todd.
Okay, and how about one from your My List?
You gave me number 11, and it's not about magicians. Number 11 is Blue Jay. It's a recent indie film. I'll read you the plot description. Two former high school sweethearts unexpectedly reunite in their hometown, where they rediscover their magical bond and face a shared regret. And this one I'm curious about because of the cast. Mark Duplass and Sarah Paulson. That's a great combo. Haven't seen it. Played at TIFF, I believe. Didn't get a chance to check it out there, but I've heard good things about it. So that's Blue Jay on Netflix.
So on our last episode, we did a giveaway. We don't get to do a lot of giveaways, so we really were appreciative to get this offer. We had Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight to give away on Blu-ray. And so I'll give one last shout out to that. Manchester by the Sea, now available on digital HD and available on Blu-ray, DVD, and on demand from Lionsgate Home Entertainment. While Moonlight is also available on digital HD, will be available on Blu-ray, DVD February 28th. So our winners, randomly chosen, Gabe in Florida, Shalikto, and Caitlin. I'll send you guys all an email, but look for my email and you can give me your address and we'll pass it along to get those Blu-rays sent out to you. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Thank you to everyone who entered. We got a lot of entries. We got a lot of listener recommendations we'll be using on the show. Got a lot of reviews. So thank you, everybody. All right. Now let's get to our listener's choice options for our next episode. We've got three relatively recent films on three different platforms. So it's a pretty good bunch this time. I think I know what's going to win, but we'll see. Our first option is available on VOD and DirecTV at the moment. It is also in limited release in theaters. We have mentioned on the show before, not this episode. I think last time it was an opening break pick from Allison. It is The Girl with All the Gifts, directed by Cole McCarthy, and with a cast that includes Gemma Arterton, Patty Considine, Glenn Close, and newcomer Senia Nanua, who plays this the girl of the title. It is basically a modern riff on a zombie movie with, I thought, a very smart sort of twist on things. It's based on a novel, and I didn't realize it. I saw this at TIFF, not knowing very much about it, and then realized after the fact it's based on a book by a comic book writer that I like, Mike Carey, I haven't read the book, but I've read a lot of his comics. And it occurs to me also just now, because of what happens in the film, it's kind of like a YA dystopian movie in a sense, but might be like one of the best ones of those that I've certainly seen. And granted, I haven't seen all of them, but I really love this movie. It's a horror movie with a lot of smarts and it's kind of got a Twilight Zone-y kind of vibe to it, especially towards the end. I really loved it, and I would like the chance to talk about it. And even if it doesn't win, it's nice to tell people it's out there, because as I was remarking on social media on Friday, like, this movie came out on Friday and very limited release, and I haven't seen anything about it. I guess if you have DirecTV or cable, you've seen some ads for it. People told me that they've seen ads for it on television. And if you have a way to see it that way, great, go for it. But even in the New York Times this weekend, there was a review for the movie, a positive review. There were no ads telling you where to see it. If you were like, oh, that sounds good, where can I find it? You really had to track it down. So it's worth seeking out, and it would be worth discussing. I'm sure we could have a lot to talk about. We could even do a whole podcast about YA dystopian movies, in fact. Wouldn't that be fun? So that is The Girl with All the Gifts, and that's available on demand or on DirecTV.
All right. Our second option is one that I've mentioned before as well, just now. It is I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. I think that definitely there's a lot to talk about, even just in the idea that one of the bigger movies from Sundance is already available on streaming. I think that's certainly a landmark moment. But also that this is a movie that is basically it's kind of like an amateur sleuth movie in some ways. It's like a buddy comedy that is about trying to right a wrong that has been done to you personally. Basically, it is Melanie Lynskey versus the jerks of the world in a way that I thought was very satisfying and gives a lot to talk about. Melanie Lynskey as a amateur detective and eventual kind of awkward action heroine is pretty delightful. And, you know, I think that we've both been fans of Jeremy Saulnier's work. So to kind of see this as a continuation and of that sensibility from one of his collaborators also, I think offers a lot to talk about. This movie uses violence in interesting and sometimes very funny ways. So that's I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. That's your second option. It is currently streaming on Netflix.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to see that one. I didn't get to cover it at Sundance, so I'm looking forward to checking that one out myself. Our third and final pick we've already mentioned on the show. It is available on Amazon Prime. It is Captain Fantastic with Viggo Mortensen. He could be an Oscar winner by the time you hear this, although I don't think that will happen, but it's his story about him and his family on this journey. We've heard great things about it. I have not seen it. Have you seen it, Allison?
I have seen it.
Okay. Is there things you would like to talk about it?
I think there is a conversation to be had about it, certainly.
Oh, what does that mean?
Well, you'll find out.
Wow. All right. Now that is a tease. Talk about a tease. Well, if you want to hear what Allison was talking about, you will have to vote for Captain Fantastic. It is available now on Amazon Prime.
All right. Well, which of these movies should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can vote in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com, our website. Things got moved around a bit there, so some old links, if you'd save any, might not work, but you can find all of our episodes there. They're still there. So you just gotta, you know, search through the menu again. But filmspottingsvu.com, it's working fine. Your vote must be received by Monday, March 6th at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is at filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that week to watch the film. And then join us for a conversation on the next episode, which will come out on Tuesday, March 14th.
Filmspottingsvu.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal, and listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. We will be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations and the review you pick, but in the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer, and follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, and where we share more streaming suggestions from you guys, the SVU listeners, as well as ourselves, mostly Allison. She's the one doing a wonderful job sharing exciting movies over there. And even though the contest is over, hey, if you forgot to send us a review on iTunes, why don't you do it? It always helps us reach new listeners, and we appreciate it. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.